session number 9752, reel 8.
Colonel Dillon, reel 8. I believe you saw your first tanks during the Battle of the Somme. Could you tell me about this first?
Yes, I was sitting with my platoon waiting to go up to follow the front line troops who had just advanced into the village of Flair for the RAF. And I was sitting with my sergeant by the roadside, and all of a sudden there was an almighty noise. The huge crater opened just behind us, within about 3 feet. Unfortunately, it was a gas shell, not a high explosive shell, so I'm still here. And at that moment I looked around and I saw a strange thing looming up through the darkness across the road. And this enormous thing crossed the road in front of me and ambled on behind the troops. And I realized now that I'd seen one of the first tanks going into action. That's what it was.
This would be the 15th of September, then, 1916.
Yes, I think it was. It would be the 15th of September.
What did you think about this tank? Did you see the potential straight away, or did
I saw the potential straight away, and I thought, I saw that's the very job for me, and I said, I'm going to get inside that box somehow, because at least I shall have some protection from the weather being the enemy.
You thought that straight away then?
I thought that straight away. And later, when the demand came for volunteers to join this new organisation, I put my name down.
How many tanks did you actually see on this first occasion?
I only saw one on this first occasion. Because naturally enough they were spread about, and unfortunately spread about along the line far too thinly. But I did see them the next day when they had been withdrawn, and there were a number of them, I think probably 4 or 5 behind the lines. I was able to get inside and talk to the crews and so on.
What did they say? What did you ask them, and what did they say?
I asked them what it was like, and they had good shooting, and they were all completely untrained in the job. They were thrust into these machines with a minimum of experience. Their comments were just dumb, I'm afraid. I know that perhaps I should be expected to tell an exciting story of blood and thunder, but it was very mundane talk from people who were completely inexperienced. Their main complaint was the mechanical inefficiency of the machines, which were prone to every sort of breakdown that you can think of.
But you were still excited at this second.
Oh yes, rather. I thought it was great fun.
Do you remember anything else about the Somme, your time on the Somme? I believe you were then moved to Lens, is that correct?
Yes, we were then moved to the Lens area.
Do you know which month that would be, approximately?
No, I have no memory of it. In the autumn sometime, late autumn.
So what was your role, what was the battalion's role at Lens?
It was, again, was fortification and improving the defence lines. And we lost some men there because the gas cylinders, which had been used in the original attack a year earlier, had been left in place. And, of course, they got broken and knocked about, and the gas escaped, and we had several casualties from that. It's a ridiculous thing to have happened, because those gas cylinders should have been removed after the original attack. They weren't. Then that was what staff work was like then.
What did you think of that? You've just mentioned it two or three times. You've mentioned higher authority, slightly scathingly. What did you think of the staff and of the generals at the time?
Not very highly. There's such a lot of muddle went on. Of course, it is excusable. You must remember there are millions of men moving about in all sorts of formations, and the staff was completely untrained to handle them. There were a few pre-war staff trained officers, but they were all years out of date. And it's really the only people who showed any ability really were, we've got young businessmen drafted in and who got into staff jobs. The Australians, the Canadians are particularly good in the organisation, and then they could organise their own little shows very well. The British Army was a colossal thing. I forget how many million there were, but it was trying to organise about 100 Wembley football supporters all in one place. They're not easy to do, especially when you have two armies crossing each other on different roads.
So you seem to feel that although the staff were incompetent and could be seen as being incompetent, it wasn't really their fault, and you don't really feel, you don't have any grudge against the actual...
Oh, individual. No, I don't think it was any willful bad conduct on the part of the staff. Naturally enough, they got fingers pointed at them because they were not being shot at all the time. The people who were being shot at were jealous of those who weren't. So you can quite understand the old quip that the bread was the staff of life, but the life on the staff was one long loaf. It wasn't really true.
Now, you went to Lent in late autumn, roughly speaking. How long was it before this call came round for volunteers for the tanks?
About a month after we had got there. I remember very well what really triggered it off, and that was that we had our commanding officer, being too old, had been posted home. We had an Indian Army major promoted to Lieutenant Colonel, put in command, and he was an extremely unpleasant chap and went out of his way to take the mickey out of all the young officers. So that was...
In what way? You say take the mickey out of...
Oh, just be unpleasant to them. You know, he said good morning to him, and said, get out of my way. That type of chap.
Rude.
Oh, that's rude, not the word for it. I naturally... got fed up with this. I didn't want to leave my platoon because I got fond of my men and I got used to them. But I thought, oh, to hell with this. This is the last straw. So I put my name down for the tanks, which were then the Heavy Branch Machine Gun Corps.
So you'd retained that interest from September. Had you learnt anything about them in the intervening 3 months?
No, nothing more.
Do you know the actual date you joined the tank corps?
Christmas Day 1916.
And what part? You say it was the Heavy Machine Gun Corps then. Which battalion was it, do you know?
It was the battalion, which later became the 2nd.
And do you know the company?
I think it was C.
What was the actual procedure for joining the tanks?
As far as I remember, one merely filled in a form asking for transfer, which was forwarded through the usual channels, and in due course you were posted in army orders as having joined.
Did they ask for any particular qualities or skills?
No, I don't think. I don't think anything was asked for. Of course, I know had an edge in coming from a pioneer battalion, but I don't remember having been asked about mechanical qualifications.
Where were they, the 2nd Battalion, when you joined them?
In a village called Pierremont, which is near I don't know.
What was the organisation of the battalion when you joined it? What did it consist of?
It consisted of four companies, A, B, C and D, and the battalion headquarters. Each company had 12 tanks. Battalion headquarters, each company had a staff car, a reconnaissance officer served with a motorcycle. The battalion had the usual trimmings of a battalion, the battalion reconnaissance officer, the motorcycle, and the usual commander's motor car. Oddly enough, we had a number of horses. What use they were to be, I do not know, but it is part of the cavalry tradition that everybody had to have a horse. And so we had each company commander had a horse, and I think there were four or five on battalion headquarters. In addition, of course, to supply animals, pack animals, and so on.
What training were you given in the tanks? Were you taken to basics and taught how to actually...
I have no memory of being taught anything. One just learnt as one went along. Of course, there were courses were held at various villages where suitable amenities existed. For instance, I went on a reconnaissance officer's course at Bellamy Corps, which was the headquarters of the tanks at that time. Others went on signalling courses.
What did the reconnaissance course consist of? What were they trying to teach you?
How to read a map, which I already could, and how to use a compass, which I already could. Field sketching, so that you could get up in a tree and take a sketch of the countryside, tell your colonel what it looked like. Laying out routes on the ground for tanks to follow at night.
How did you do that?
With white tapes with a black mark through the middle, which is known as tank tapes. You laid these on the ground, and at night you would follow them in a tank. Because it sounds all right in open country, but when you get amongst shell holes and gun emplacements and trenches, it's a very different matter. So we were taught that. Finding a way about at night by compass, which is not so easy if you set somebody a quadrilateral course with compass bearings and set them forth in the dark. Very few of them will come back to the starting point.
Did you have any difficulties with any parts of this training? Were you all right with all the...
Well, it all came naturally to me, really, because I'd been a Boy Scout and I'd learnt all the usual Boy Scouting things. It was a tremendous help to me. Surprising how few people could read a map. When I left the battalion at the end of the war, my commanding officer couldn't read a map. Only the colonel could read a map. Very few people could. And that's astonishing. Without a bit of instruction. Of course, tank commanders could read a map because they were given a little segment to read, which was just their route and what they were doing, and the compass bearing on it.
After you'd been on this reconnaissance officer's course, were you appointed a reconnaissance officer to one of the companies?
Yes, I was. I was appointed to C Company.
Now, just the other side of training, well, you said you had no formal training, but could you describe to us just exactly who was in a tank and what they all did? I know that's quite complicated.
Well, in those days, the tank was a very primitive machine. It was only knocked together from existing bits and pieces. And it had a driver who worked the pedals and accelerator and so on, an officer who sat beside him and who worked the brakes. Then there were two men at the back, one on each side of the center portion of the tank, because on each side there was a gearing, what was called a secondary gearing, so you could drive if you liked with one side of the tank in top gear and the other side in second gear. And the result would be, of course, that the tracks would move unevenly, and the track would swing in its tank would swing in its movement. And that is the chief method of turning. You had to put the clutch out and get the man at the back of the car to the tank to put the appropriate gear in. It was a very tricky business. Then there were two other men on each side. One who manned the 6-pounder gun, and the other one a machine gun. So there were 8 men in that tank altogether. Not much room for dancing.
What was the officer's role within this? Did he just tell everybody else what to do, or did he have a specific thing he was in charge of?
He's theoretically supposed to tell everybody what to do, and but chiefly. His role was in guiding the thing in the direction it ought to go. He had 2 levers. Each one activated a brake on the tracks, so that it was a method of steering. But the brakes were quite inefficient and of very little use. The officer's role, he couldn't do much commanding of the tank, because of the frightful racket that went on inside. If he saw anything through his visor that the gunners ought to get onto, he would probably lean back, get hold of the gunner and shout in his ear. It wasn't a question of issuing an order, it was a question of getting odd things done.
Could the you say they had brakes. Would this braking system that the officer controlled for direction, would that be strong enough to overcome the gearing direction system, which was the, you implied earlier, the gears were actually the main way of changing
They were the main way of changing direction, because they were a positive means. If you put... and put the differential gear in and locked it in, so it didn't work, and you could put one side of the tank track into neutral and the other side into gear, then you've got a positive turn. You could turn right round on a sixpence, but of course it took time to do it. By putting on the brakes you could get a gradual steering movement, especially on good ground, but the brakes were not designed for that purpose, you see, for a 30-ton vehicle. They were part of the make-up of the Foster Damon tractor of which the tank was built. The engine differential, back axle, all brakes all came from the Foster Damon agricultural tractor, so those brakes were adequate for holding a tractor on the road, but they went up to 30 tons of steel sitting on them.
It sounds to me as if there was room for confusion within the tank as to which way it was going to steer, as if the officer could be thinking one thing and the gearsman thinking with the driver that something else. Would that sort of thing really happen, or were they able to communicate by shouting?
Oh no, the officer presumably would tell the driver, we want to turn to the right here by the side of this wood, and the driver would then issue his signal to his pal behind, usually by rapping on the engine cover with a spanner. two wraps mean bottom gear, one wrap means top gear. That sort of thing. Others had whistles. Others went by a series of shouts. Really, it's quite a thing to see a company of tanks go past with the noise that went on inside.
Just how loud was the noise? Is there anything you can compare it to?
I can't think of anything at the moment. You couldn't hear anything. You couldn't talk to anybody inside the tank. You had to shout in their ear. There was a tremendous racket of not from the engine, which was a sleeve valve engine, but from the tracks and the rollers and things going round. That was in the secondary gears. It made a terrible noise. You'd think you were going at 100 miles an hour to sit there and listen to it, but if you looked out at the ground, it was going past at a walking pace. It was your top speed.
What was the effect in the tank when either the machine gun or the six-pounder fired?
We've got a lot of extra noise, if you could make any difference. But you've got a good deal of fumes from them too. It was rather unpleasant. Fumes blowing back. And of course, one experienced a lot of injury from flash from the inside of the plates. We had a machine gun playing on the outside of the plates. The inside, where the bullets hit it, would flake away in little red-hot splinters. And we were issued with masks, visors, to protect our faces. The trouble was you couldn't see a damn thing through them. So we rarely wore them. You see tank crews coming out of the action very often. They look as if they've come from a piratical expedition, because their faces were running with blood, and all their arms and hands too. And of course, it was only superficial. Very nasty, all the same.
You mentioned the fumes from when the guns were fired. Did you have a problem with fumes from the engine within the tank?
No. I can't remember particularly, unless the exhaust pipes got shot away a bit, and then you got fumes inside. I think perhaps the worst type of fume was the petrol leakage, which one used to get from time to time. That made a terrible smell.
Would that make the crews ill?
Yes. It had an effect. And if you got, very often you would have a small fire caused by bullets coming in and striking against the petrol pipe or something like that. Then the fumes from the fire extinguisher are almost worse than the fire itself.
Now, getting back more to perhaps towards the area when you were first getting into the tanks, did you actually take a turn at each of these jobs to familiarise yourself of gearsman, driver, manning the guns? Did you actually have a go at those, would you just be the officer?
In actual fact, I didn't have a go at any of them. I knew roughly how they all worked. But I was drafted in as a reconnaissance officer before I had any need to exercise any skills in gunnery or anything like that.
So you never... Were you ever actually the officer in charge of a tank, or were you just along for the ride at that stage?
Only on one occasion. I took over a tank during the Battle of Arras in 1917.
We'll come to that then. Were you trained at all in tank tactics at this time, when you first joined?
There were no tank tactics when I joined. Only tactics in existence at that time were to get into your tank and drive towards the enemy, and the infantry with any luck would follow you. They were thinking in terms of squadrons wheeling about and making strategic moves. But you must remember that these creatures, top speed was only 4 miles an hour, and the actual practical effect of the battlefield, it was about more like one.
Was there any sort of methods taught of how to get across a large German trench, or how to clear a German trench? Would that sort of level of tactics be thought about at all?
No. There was no, as far as I remember, no training in that sort of thing. The situation explained itself. You got halfway across a German trench and fired up and down it. That was your job, and you hoped the infantry would come in and take over when you'd gone on.
So it was rough and ready.
Very rough and ready.
Now, you were appointed as reconnaissance officer to C Company. Mm. When was it you actually took that role on? How long after you joined on Christmas Day, 16?
I suppose it would be about a month or so after I had joined. We'd all settled down together. I can't remember the exact date.
That's all right.
What time?
What was your role then as a reconnaissance officer behind the lines? What were you all doing at this village?
My job was to try and teach the tank commanders how to steer a tank with their compasses, because they had a compass on board the tank, you must remember, and they wanted training in using that and in map reading. So that is an important thing for me to do. I must say that there wasn't very much to do at that time from the reconnaissance officer's point of view. But shall we go on?
Yes.
I was sent off shortly after that to the Lens area again, where it was proposed to develop an attack. And I was sent down there to make some sketches of the country and to see where the tanks could be got into position. So I took my draftsman along with me. We climbed up into one of those pit headgear things that there are about 100 feet above the ground. And we had a marvellous view of all the German lines, all the trenches and everything for miles. And we made all sorts of sketches and provided routes and approaches and came back. Whether it was that day or the next one, I can't remember, but we were walking past the first aid post of the battalion in reserve when some German gunner must have spotted us and had a pot shot and hit us both with a burst of shrapnel above our heads. I was had a piece lodged in my cheek, and my draftsman had a bit in his tongue. And so we were both out of the battle, and I was evacuated home, where it was taken out.